What happened Friday night?
I recorded like everything.
Of what?
Of you and
oh, front of me killing it at the Palladium?
Yeah, I recorded front of me at the Palladium. I recorded Puddle of Mud. I recorded some of the other bands that were there, and it was awesome. I'm gonna have a video coming out soon.
It was a very good night.
Fuck yeah.
Boop. Welcome to the Darkest Side Podcast, where we delve into the darkest side of our existences. The morbid, the macabre, the spooky, and the absurd are all fair games as we discuss murder, UFOs, cryptids, creepypasta, the paranormal, and the dark depravity of the human soul. I am David. And with me is Forrest and Herman. How are we today?
Doing amazing.
I could not be any better.
Yeah, it's been a good day.
Yeah,
it
has been a nice day.
Pleasant, wonderful, pleasant, not. Yeah, it's kind of spooky and ominous. It's getting a little dark and maybe stormy.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I like dark and stormies.
Yeah.
We should drink those next time.
Those are actually pretty good.
Yeah, they're pretty great.
Yeah, we'll definitely Daniels. Have to do that.
I have some nice Caribbean rum from Newfoundland, Canada. Don't think too hard about that.
Unfortunately, we don't have any sponsors for today's episode.
DCP Network.
Well, we could. You know, this is sponsored by the DCP Network. You guys should all go check out the DCP Network. We've got some good podcasts there.
Yeah.
End of sponsorship.
Yeah, right. Hell yeah.
Well, let's jump right into this, guys. We're going to get into our news stories. Let's do this a little bit differently. Forrest, what do you got for a news story for us?
Hell yeah. Putting me right on the spot.
Exactly.
I like that. This is a crazy ass motherfucking story. I mean, the second I found it, I was just like, wow, I need to do this. And, this comes from CTV News. This, I guess it was updated at some point, September 10th, something like that. So the title of this is called Canadian Spotted 3 UFOs per day in 2017, according to a survey.
That's quite a bit of so that's what, 306? That's over 1,000 sightings per for the whole year.
That was good math.
Yeah.
Yeah, good job.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of UFOs.
Yeah, that's a lot of sightings. And I mean, in Canada's.
It's a vast.
It's sparsely
land.
Populated. I mean, it's tightly populated
it's a big
cities,
country.
Continent. But otherwise, it's a very sparse population.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of green woods and stuff up there. So
snow.
So basically, so this was a survey taken that on average 3 sightings per day in Canada for the whole time, huh? For that whole year in 2017. That's a
Apparently.
Lot of fucking sightings, man.
That is a very many.
So going forward, last September, 10 campers in Quebec say they watched as a glowing pyramid-shaped object floated above their trailer and came to a halt mid-air. The group says the unusual object hovered above the campsite and emitted an intense red light. A moment later, the light flickered and it flew out of sight.
Now, Quebec sits on a major body of water, correct? Am I wrong?
Quebec is just north of Maine. That's where Montreal is. So they have the St. Lawrence waterway.
Which leads into
Lake Erie, but I think once you get to that piece, you're more towards Toronto, Ontario,
right, okay,
area.
Yeah, so, but you're still on a major body of water, as Forrest would say, water.
Yeah.
But these water sites, these heavy flowing water sites or big lakes and stuff like that around that entire bottom part of that side of Canada. There are so many sites.
Oh, there's tons of lakes and rivers up there too. It's beautiful. Highly recommend. Go.
Oh, it's
go.
Awesome.
Eat the poutine. Speak some French.
And you have a fairly good chance of witnessing a UFO.
Pretty much from the sound of this. It's crazy. I don't know if I'd want to go camping out there. I mean, it'd be fun, but.
Oh, I recommend it.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I would. I've never been up that north, but, you know, Maine onward. I'm sure it's a beautiful camping area, but.
Yeah.
Shit, I would go camping just for the pure chance. I mean.
Oh, yeah. I think
any time I've ever had a UFO experience, except, you know, the ones that I could consciously remember.
Yeah, right.
Who knows subconsciously what has happened to me. But I've all been weird, cool, interesting experiences. I would never give them up. I've never truly been afraid of seeing a UFO, and I've seen multiple ones.
Maybe we should all go camping then.
Yeah, sounds like a good Darker Side podcast
record
trip.
It.
Yeah, maybe we can see some UFOs up there.
Or some cryptids.
Fuck yeah.
We can eat some pasta.
So going forward, the unexplained encounter is one of the best documented UFO sightings reported in Canada in 2017.
Well, with documentation is how we can get these stories out there, and the more supportive. What, there were five people at that witnessed it at that one thing?
Technically, last year, 1,101 people reported seeing unusual lights and shapes in Canada's skies. According to the annual Canadian UFO survey released by UFOlogy Research of Manitoba.
Mm-hmm. Ufologists.
Yeah.
Yeah, ufologists. That's
ufologists,
cool.
Yeah.
That's cool, ufologists, okay. The amounts to about 3 UFO sightings in Canada each day.
Yeah.
It was the fifth highest number of sightings since the survey began in 1989, says science writer Chris Rutkowski, who spearheaded the project.
So this means that they've had 4 other years on record that where they saw even more per day.
That's interesting. Yeah, it does.
Yep.
Hmm.
And quoting Rutkowski, UFOs still seem to be the thing. They haven't gone away, and they don't seem to be declining in any numbers, Rutkowski told CTV News.
They actually cleaned that up. It was, UFOs are the thing, man. It's not like the thing because it's the thing, but it's the thing to do. You dig?
I mean, I'm not going to lie. I mean, I hate to get into this with, Canada and America, but I have to say, like, it definitely sounds like America is totally covering something up then because, I mean,
well,
you know.
Well, your UFO organizations, MUFON and the others in this country that do, people report to them. Right. And they put out their reports every year, too, based on the records, sighting amounts, details, et cetera.
You can click on dates and locations.
It's definitely not talked about by our media.
Oh, no, it wouldn't be. It's government. Not covered by our media.
Are you kidding me? They just came out, the government just came out admitting that UFOs were real not too long ago. I believe we reported on that.
Yeah, we did report on it, but I mean, they're not.
They don't care.
Our news medias aren't picking up on it is like great as some of these other countries.
And our government doesn't care either.
No, who cares?
I think Justin Trudeau from Canada actually came out and talked about the existence of UFOs and the need to plan.
Well, yeah. That makes me proud of him then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Be honest with us.
Yeah, no kidding.
Fuck yeah.
Is that basically the end or?
Supposedly, about 1/3 of last year's cases had a logical explanation, such as a solar flare, drone, or shooting star. Another 1/3 of cases didn't include enough information to be sufficiently studied, but 10 cases had a high degree of both reliability and strangeness and are what the UFO researchers describe as high-quality unknowns.
Oh, I love that. High-quality unknowns.
Yeah, you're going to have some of them every once in a while, right?
Yeah.
That's good.
And that's all that matters. They have those, and that's enough to, enough evidence. It's crazy. HQU, high quality unknowns.
High quality unknowns. But you want to dig on some of this high quality unknown?
Right. It's fucking crazy. It's insane. Like, it's just, it's crazy because I love Canada. You know, I can totally see myself living there in 5 or 10 years. And,
well, you got a good chance of seeing a UFO up there, bro.
Hell yeah.
You know, that's all. That'd scary, be worth the whole thing.
Yeah, we'll come visit.
Right.
Our remote Canadian outpost.
I'll call you guys and be like, hey, you know what? I saw a UFO last night. I might have been abducted. I don't know.
You know, you'll never know.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Well, Forrest, thank you for that awesome news story there.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Here is my news story. It's a Christian author. Trump is under attack from multidimensional Luciferian advanced beings.
Of course he is. It's so simple.
So this was this happened a little bit back in May of this year, but it's still funny as hell. Last week, End Times author Paul McGuire appeared on the Jim Baker Show and declared that President Trump is currently engulfed in the greatest spiritual battle in the history of all mankind. He explained on his claim on this radio program this Thursday that this clarifying that the battle is with advanced beings who possess supernatural multidimensional powers. It even gets weirder.
Hmm.
The physical battles that we see in our world and nation right now are a direct manifestation of the spiritual battles going on in the invisible realm. McGuire said in an audio clip flagged by right-wing watch, of course. There are people very high up in what is called the globalist occult of, or globalist Luciferian rulership system. And this rulership system consists of what used to be called the Pharaoh God Kings.
Ooh. I like it.
Did you mention where the story's coming from?
I will. It comes from Dead State.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a Dead State article.
So you know it's reliable, so Trump really is the puppet of Luciferian interdimensional satanic metalheads. I'm losing it. It was too many adjectives.
Yeah,
too
it's
too many descriptors.
So it's the Pharaoh God Kings, or what used to be called the Pharaoh God Kings. It's what Aldous Huxley called the scientific dictatorship.
Oh.
Yeah, so the sciencey people who are, you know, being led by Satan to do his nefarious biddings. Called the scientific dictatorship, and there are advanced beings who know how to tap into supernatural multidimensional power and integrate it with science, technology, and economics, he continued.
Where do you think the iPhone came from?
Of course. It's either, yeah, of course, that or it's retrofitted advanced technology that we've got from the UFOs that we spoke of.
Or from the satanic pharaohs of the sky.
Or,
I mean, it's so simple. I don't understand what's wrong with you.
Or time cops.
The time cops.
Exactly. McGuire even had the hierarchical structure of these advanced beings pegged, saying that they are at the highest level of pyramidic organizational structures in which the highest ranking officers, if you will, of the New World Order and Mystery Babylon. That sounds like a great reggae song, man.
Yeah.
Mystery Babylon.
In the New World Order. Yeah. So good. It writes itself. Right? Smoke the ganja, New World Order.
Mystery Babylon.
Yeah, oh, man, we're going to work on this for the next one.
Are ruling the earth through an organizational structure that looks like the pyramid on the back of the U.S. dollar.
Uh-oh. Oh, my God. So not only is it UFO pharaohs from outer space that are satanic, but also the Illuminati.
Oh, yeah.
Play a role in this?
Quite possibly.
See, it's all connected. It's all interconnected and designed to keep you down and rule you from afar and take all of your money.
Mystery Babylon, they don't take us down.
Right.
So we gotta lift ourselves higher.
Higher!
Higher!
Smoke that ganja.
Oh my God.
Nice. And they control the world because they understand that the true control of the world is done through supernatural mechanisms.
Of course it is. It's so simple. It's not your voting or your hanging chads.
Well, I guess Hollywood was right all this time.
End of news story. So we know that this guy's a fucking nut job. But hey,
or
who knows?
Is he? He might be the only person with the real truth, Dave.
What's the background this guy comes from, like politically?
He's an end times author. He's a Christian, like a Christian, a Christ follower.
Oh, science, yes.
He's a man of the book.
The man of the book who is also deeply enriched in this backroom darkness.
He hates Trump. Obviously, he doesn't really.
No, he
care
loves
Trump.
He loves Trump because he says that he's being attacked by these super dimensional creatures.
Trump's fighting the sky pharaohs
He's fighting the fight so that our souls will be preserved in righteousness for the rest of the world. And he's fighting these interdimensional beings who have Luciferian powers. And
interesting.
Yeah. So End Times is a news organization that preaches the end times of the world as according to the book.
Yeah.
The Fire and Brimstone Bible.
Yeah, exactly. So, and his background is that he writes for this, and he's also a pastor, a Christian author, so.
Ah.
Yeah, so that's his view on why Trump is killing it right now, because he's fighting these dimensionals.
Yeah.
This would actually make a really good prog rock or a degent metal sort of concept album,
exactly.
I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. All right, Herman, what do you got for us for a news story? You got a little...
I don't have anything quite as heavy as all of that.
Which is good, because you got to lighten up the mood a little.
Gotta
so
balance.
We at the Darker Side Podcast are not ableist in any way, so I wanted to bring this piece of knowledge to all of you. A man with no arms stabbed a tourist in Florida, police say. This comes from USA Today, so you know it's fake. Miami Beach police say 46-year-old Jonathan Crenshaw held a pair of scissors with his feet and stabbed 22-year-old Cesar Coronado just after midnight Tuesday. This is from the Miami Herald. Crenshaw is well known in Miami Beach as a street artist who uses his feet to paint, according to local media. Coronado was bleeding from his left arm when he was admitted to the local hospital. Crenshaw did claim he acted in self-defense. Problem with that was Coronado had another friend with him who said it was not self-defense. He was merely asking for directions. So, hey, where do I get a good Cuban sandwich? Stab, stab, stab. Going to the hospital.
But wow. There's no stab, stab, stab with his arms.
He used his feet.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking.
It's a very interesting and it's a very appropriate Floridian news story.
It sounds like Florida. Yeah.
If it sounds like it came out of a carny, it's coming from Florida.
Or Texas.
North to south, east to west, doesn't matter. That part of that state is full of amazing and interesting news stories.
Oh,
it's all walks of life down there, and it's the heat in the swamp, I think, that really just gets inside.
Alligators.
I can only imagine that amount of humidity and heat always. And then when it's not, it's stormy as fuck.
Yeah.
Stormy as fuck. Yeah,
it's like it's either heat or humidity or absolute just chaos with weather.
Yeah. I can't wait.
But yeah, man, that's a perfect story. And again, something to bring us out of that other heavy stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good job, guys.
Good job.
That is the Darker Side news stories for today, guys.
Just dropping knowledge like dropping bombs on you.
Heavy bombs, y'all.
Oh, yeah.
All right, we're going to get into Creepypasta Corner, guys.
Yeah.
I got a pretty lengthy one, but it's a good one. All right, guys. Well, this is a creepypasta called The Fourth Child. You can find this on creepypasta.com. Again, it's called The Fourth Child. My mother, my siblings, and I moved into this awesome new house a few months ago. It's a really cool plantation-style home out of the way, out in what was once a rural area outside of New Orleans. By now, the area is a little more built up, so it's really more like a spacious suburb. Anyway, it had been about 9 months since our father died. My mom really wanted us to get away from our old house. It was full of too many memories. She wanted us to have a cool, spacious house to play in and give us a fresh start. Apparently, we got this place at a decent deal because the former owner was the old woman who passed away, and her family wanted to get the extra house off their hands. She died peacefully in her sleep, but it still made us a little uncomfortable, so no one moved into her bedroom. We just let it be a guest room if at any time we had visitors. We had a wonderful neighbor named Miss Leah, who lived next door to us, about half a mile away. She is a small but powerful built woman who welcomed us to the area with open arms. The former owner of the house was an old friend of hers, and she visited all the time, and my own mother took out the role of her new friend. They immediately became best friends, always giggling in our kitchen on the weekends. Miss Leah loves telling tales of voodoo.
Voodoo.
I know picture as Miss Leah.
Miss Leah.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God.
I don't know what that accent was. Hey, Miss Leah.
They're like a Miss Cleo.
Come on, out of the pizza.
Miss Leah loves telling tales of voodoo and open practices it herself. Many people in New Orleans do. She mostly practices the light voodoo. Obviously, there's a deeper doo-doo.
Oh, so diet voodoo.
Right. Like charms for good luck and protection. She told me that you can talk to spirits if you write them letters and put them in place where you know to find them. I started seeing her every now and then, late at night, when I can't sleep, sticking envelopes in her mailbox. I can see it from my window. When I go out in the morning, though, no envelopes would be there. One night I saw her doing the usual mailbox routine, and as soon as she walked far enough away, I ran out to see what she was putting in her mailbox. I saw little silvery, unaddressed letters to Maggie, which turns out to be the name of the old lady who lived in the house before us. I always thought Miss Leah was joking about talking to the dead, but it's clear she practices it herself. Just to test things out, I stood at the mailbox watching for a few hours. Eventually, the sun began to break over the horizon, so I figured I had waited ample time. I opened the mailbox. The letter was gone. At first, I was in complete disbelief, but then I was overcome with excitement. If Miss Leah could talk to Maggie, maybe I could talk to my dad.
Wow.
I kept a little shoebox under my own bed. It's full of little trinkets and pictures that reminded me of my dad. I go through it every now and then when I miss him most, as sort of a therapy. A few nights after trying to rationalize what had happened to me the night with a note to Maggie, I decided the best way was to test it out was to try it myself. I wrote a letter to my dad, which felt silly at first because I don't know what dead people like to talk about. I wrote, "Dear Daddy, miss you. How are things on the other side? Mom bought this cool house for us, and we have a fun neighbor named lady named Miss Leah. We're all doing okay over here, but I especially miss waking up every morning to the sounds of your loud singing in the shower. I hated it back then, but now I realize how funny and charming it was. Sincerely, Julia.
Oh, that's cute.
Wow.
I placed a note into my special shoebox and slipped it back under the bed. When I woke up in the morning, it wasn't there. I wasn't sure how to handle it. Did he really get the message? Does he write back? What do I do now? Well, I still needed to go to school that day, so with the excitement of my supernatural letter writing subsided, I headed over to the bathroom to get ready. My older brother was singing his lungs out in the shower, something unusual for him, but I figured he was trying to become more like our dad. I knocked on the door. Hurry up in there. I need to pee. The singing continued. Jay, how much longer are you going to take? The singing continued. Then someone tapped on my shoulder. I turned around. It was Jay. He said, calm down, Julia. I'm not in the bathroom. Is the door locked? Let me see if I can jimmy it open for you. He opened the door with ease. The bathroom was empty. No singing. The shower wasn't running, but the tub was wet. I walked in and I started brushing my teeth. Amused by what had just happened, I noticed the mirror. There was a little bit foggy, as though from the shower steam, there was a message written in the mirror. It said, how bad do you miss me?
What?
I walked the fine line between being totally freaked out and super elated that my dad was communicating with me. I wrote another letter that night. Haha, I miss you more than you can possibly imagine, Daddy. Don't ever doubt that, but tell me, how are things on the other side? That morning I woke up, the letter in the shoebox was gone. But I noticed a new letter near my door. It looked like someone slipped it under there. I opened it up. It said, what do you want most from me? I found it weird that my dad wasn't really carrying the conversation well, but I decided to write a quick response and go to school. I wrote, well, I guess what I want most is for you to come back and play with me like old times, but I know that's silly. When I got back from school, I went straight to my room to check on the letter. I opened the door, and my dollhouse, which was stored in the attic, was smack in the middle of the floor. My mom had been at work all day, my brother was still at swim practice, and my sister went to the mall with her friend after dropping me off at home. I don't know who could have moved it, except maybe my dad. I saw a note next to the dollhouse that said, play with me.
I would have just asked for like a peanut butter and jelly with no crust.
Hell yeah, right?
My body froze. Something was unsettling about this whole setup. I didn't feel like I was in danger or anything, but I just wasn't comfortable. I walked to Miss Leah's house, and she was sitting on the rocking chair on the front porch with her cat, Rufus, in her lap. Of course she had a cat named Rufus. I told her I knew about the letter she wrote to Maggie. Ah, yes, sweetheart. Ah, yes, sweetheart, she said. Even though she passed, I haven't stopped talking to Miss Maggie one bit. She was my best friend, and I want her to know how much I love her and how much Rufus misses the little tuna treats she'd give him. I write her almost every day, just updating her on the life, and so when I pass, too, I'll be like, she didn't miss a beat. She asked me if I was thinking about writing to the dead, too. For some reason, I didn't feel comfortable telling Miss Leah that I had been writing to my dad already. I told her I was considering writing a letter to my dad and that I would try it out that night. She laughed. Okay, honey. You have to let me know how it goes tomorrow. I played with Rufus for a little while, and Miss Leah talked on the phone with her nephew. The sun started going down, and I figured it was about time for dinner, so I said goodbye to Miss Leah and Rufus and walked back to my house. My mom and everyone else was already back. My God, where have you been? My mom yelled. I told her I was hanging out with Miss Leah, which eased her nerves a little bit since she knew I had been home alone for a while, which scared her. My sister was grounded for abandoning me that afternoon, but she said it was smart of me to go to Miss Leah's. She then said, you know that dollhouse was expensive, right? Which seemed like an odd question, but I answered, yes, I suppose. Why? She said, explain, well, I guess I just wish you'd taken better care of it, is all. I saw it in your room when I was looking for you and could see you picked off it all its paint and there were some dings and dents and I just thought it was such a shame. Also, next time you're getting something out of the attic, wait until I get home and I can help you, honey. Bewildered by my mother's comments, I ate dinner in silence afterwards. Afterwards, I helped with the dishes and made my way back to the room with apprehension. It seemed like the dollhouse was in great condition last I saw it, so I knew something must have happened after I left. I prayed my mom was just seeing things, that the dollhouse was indeed exactly how I left it. I opened my door. My mom was wrong. The dollhouse wasn't a little dinged up. It had been ripped to bits. its tattered remains were strewn on the floor. Even my little dolls were mangled with their arms snapped backwards and their heads missing. I couldn't fathom what had just happened. Then I saw the letter. Why won't you play with me? My hair stood on end. Ooh. I could feel the rage emanating throughout the room. I tried to rationalize. I tried to tell myself that the context made my senses rage. But there was nothing to worry about. But how can you rationalize things when you're going around writing letters to dead people who break your furniture? Mm-hmm. I felt terrible that I'd upset my father in this way. He bought me that dollhouse himself, so it must have hurt to destroy it. I immediately wrote a new letter to my dad saying, Daddy, I'm so sorry for not playing with you. I love you, but I think we need to let it go. You belong on the other side. I belong here. I just want to say one more thing, something I never got a chance to say before. Goodbye, Daddy. Julia. I slept with my brother that night. He was nice about it and didn't even ask what I was afraid of. He could tell I was disturbed and he didn't want to push me. Before we went to bed, he did say one last thing. You know there's no such thing as monsters, right? Yes, I whispered. At that point, I wasn't sure if I was lying or not. It was still comforting to say it. I didn't think I was dealing with a monster, at least. I wasn't sure about it. I didn't even really know what a monster was supposed to be. A dragon? A boogeyman in the closet? An angry father? The next day was Saturday, and I still wasn't comfortable being in my room for long. I got dressed, walked to Miss Leah's. I wanted to leave the house without checking the shoebox. It felt like I was leaving an angry parent and wanted to give them time to cool off before we talked again. Miss Leah was sitting with Rufus, as usual, and they both watched the Blue Jays hop around in their yard, which is a thing you can do quite frequently in the South.
Mm. Yeah.
Rufus slightly more attentive than Miss Leah. Well, hey there, sweetheart, Miss Leah called out. How did it go last night? I knew she was talking about the letter, and I knew she'd known exactly how to fix things, but before I could begin speaking, she interrupted. Let me guess. It didn't work. Why would you say that? I asked. Because I know better than anyone else the spirits can't move physical objects. I have to use my special charm paper to write to Maggie, and I doubt you got any charm paper. Oh.
No.
She ain't got no charm paper. I felt a little ashamed after that. I'm not sure why. I guess I just felt like I'd been deceiving Miss Leah. I didn't tell her the whole story. I just told her I thought it worked because the letter was gone. Well, Julia, my best guess is you got a prankster in your house. Probably your brother. He's too silly for his age. She went on about it, all the things she told Maggie. She said it didn't happen often, as if it was hard for Maggie's frail little spirit to do much of anything except read. But Maggie would sometimes write back. Maggie said she hadn't crossed over yet, but when she did cross over, she wouldn't be able to get letters anymore. Maggie said that she loved Miss Leah in her letters, but one day she'd need to move on. She said eventually Miss Leah wouldn't have the strength to write letters, and they would become fewer and fewer. Once Maggie knew it was too hard for Miss Leah to write anymore, she'd cross over and wait patiently with Petunia, another one of Miss Leah's cats who had passed away.
Oh.
Maggie said Miss Leah would know when she crossed over because her letters would stay in the mailbox and no one would take them. I wandered home later that afternoon, wondering if Dad was ever going to cross over. I wasn't sure how to feel. I know what I saw and what I did. I wrote letters to my dad. I left them where he'd checked, our box. They were gone later. I heard him in the shower. I saw his message in the mirror. I saw the dollhouse in his notes. I know no one in the house could have moved the dollhouse. I was certain it was Daddy. I arrived in my room, fragments of the dollhouse still scattered on the floor. I remembered the last letter I wrote, the one that asked my dad to move on. I was afraid he'd be angry with me. I was afraid he'd accuse me of not loving him enough, of lying to him. I didn't want to check the box, but I needed to see if he got the message. It opened. The letter was gone. But in its place was a new letter. It said Julia on the cover, so I knew it was for me, and I figured he wrote back. I opened it, and I was horrified at what I saw. Daddy isn't here.
What, row?
I bolted down the stairs and prepared to run back to Miss Leah's to explain everything, but I didn't have to. She was there, giggling with my mom in the kitchen. I started walking toward them, but there was something on the other side of the division between the kitchen and living room where I could still see it, but Mom and Miss Leah couldn't. We put a framed picture of Dad there in order to remember him. There was a note on the picture. It said, "Say a word, and they're dead." I wasn't sure what to do. I knew I needed to keep quiet, but I also knew that something very, very sinister was going on, and there was nothing I could do to stop it. My sister and brother were going to a big house party, and my mom wanted to go hang with the other girlfriend, with her other girlfriend that night. So Miss Leah actually came over to take me to her house that night. My mom tried to apologize for the late notice, but I was so excited to get out of the house and away from whatever it was, and she didn't even get to finish her apology. Last night, Miss Leah let me stay up late with her and Rufus. Around 12, she started writing a letter on her special charm paper, and it was very thin and glowed silvery hue. I asked her how to make it, and she said that it comes from the soul. We walked out of my house. We walked to my house together and put the letter in the mailbox. The next day, my mom picked me up. It was stopped in the mailbox because someone had pulled the letter up. There was a note from Miss Leah there, and I knew exactly whom it was from. The paper had the same thinness and silvery glow. Mom wrote it off as someone dropping it off in the wrong mailbox and asked if I would run back to give it to Miss Leah. I sprinted down the street to Miss Leah's. She opened up the letter and began reading while I sat and waited with Rufus. When she was done, Miss Leah's face turned pale. I never thought I'd see such a white porcelain complexion on a living human being. All the color was gone from her face, and she trembled. She was clearly disturbed, very disturbed. She told me not to go home, but she'd call my mom and everyone would come over for lunch. She immediately put down the letter and picked it up the phone. Once her back was turned, I took the letter to read it. Dearest Leah, so sorry I've taken such a long time to write you back. It seems that I lack the spiritual power necessary to write. Heck, I couldn't hardly even write when I saw I was alive and had hands. The lady who moved into my house with her family is lovely as ever, and I want you to know that I've been watching y'all's friendships, and I'm so happy for you. I miss giggling in the kitchen with you, but watching you and her talk is almost as good. I bet you meet all the children as well. Most of them are sweet as can be. Jay has a heart of gold and seems to really care about the family. Catherine has a great sense of humor, always makes me and the rest of the family laugh. Julia is a curious little one. She reminds me a bit of you. Then there's the fourth child. It's a vicious little thing. You know the one I'm talking about? The one with the black eyes and the long, dark claws that lives in my old room? It's always causing a ruckus. I'm glad I'm dead because that little scoundrel really gives me the creeps. And watches over poor Julia as she sleeps and leaves awful little notes around the house. I noticed it the other day, and it started taking knives out of the drawers at night and bringing them under the bed with it. That mother should really do something about keeping it under control. Perhaps you could help with that. Can't wait for our next correspondence. Fondly, Maggie. I couldn't breathe. I just sat frozen as Miss Leah screamed into the phone. Oh, God, tell me you're all okay. Pick up the phone, please. Pick up the phone. She decided to call 911. When the police got to my house, Miss Leah and I waited outside. They found my mom, my brother, and my sister. They found them all over the house, lacerated into shreds of flesh. They couldn't determine how it happened. Figured it was a wild animal or something. But Miss Leah and I knew what happened. While we were waiting outside the house, we both looked up into my bedroom window, standing there in the room where I slept at night. Was a black-eyed child with an evil grin that stretched ear to ear. It raised one long, sharp finger, probably 12 inches long, to its mouth as if to say, "Shh." Shh. That was a sweet little creepypasta about a black-eyed child. If you haven't heard about the black-eyed children, I suggest you go out and do some research.
They're beautiful.
Fucking don't crazy. Let them into your fucking house.
Just don't.
Yeah. Oh, God. Just don't. That was a lengthy one, guys, and thanks for sitting through that, but I think the payoff is worth it.
That's a good story,
so
yeah.
Worth
absolutely,
it.
Absolutely. Fuck and the writer of this, again, I'm not really sure, but, I mean, good on you.
Yeah.
It was a cool little twist of like black, including the black-eyed children, was awesome in my opinion.
Hell yeah!
Yeah.
Creepy. All right, guys. Well, that was a Creepypasta Corner. It was a little interesting piece that we did there. Let's get into the diving deeper into the darker side segment, The Hart Brothers Part Two.
Part Deux.
Hell yeah!
So when last we left our heroes, they were being pursued for the sum of $300. $50,000 today, by Kentucky Governor James Girard, I think. I don't know, Gerard, whatever I said last time was right.
Yeah.
So at this point, the Harps began to make their way up to the bowling green area, where they ran into a man by the name of Frederick Stump, which is an unfortunate name.
Unfortunately.
Stump was fishing in an area near where the Harps were camping and saw the smoke from the fire. Thinking some new friends were in the area, Stump ran to grab his violin and a turkey for dinner. He arrived at the Harps' camp.
Wait, you just say violin and turkey?
Yeah. Violin and turkey,
He
yeah.
had cooked up a turkey and saw the smoke from his friends, or who he thought would be some friendly people in the woods, brought his harp over, and the turkey that he had cooked.
Yeah, like, you know.
fucking living in the wilderness by yourself is a lonely ordeal. A couple people just like you, maybe a little bit down the ways.
Take a nice journey.
Yeah,
some crusty folks. Sup, guys? Y'all want to listen to some fiddle music and eat this here turkey and get weird?
And discover yourself.
Discover yourself. Naturally, his body was found floating in the river, and his innards were also replaced with rocks. It's sort of their calling card, I think.
Their MO, they're like...
Yeah.
Yeah. their calling card. It's
sort of the shittiest dinner party ever.
Like the Wet Bandits, right? Except they're the rock stomach hole fillers.
I was thinking more of the Sticky Bandits.
Yeah.
Like, whatever that was. All right.
Home Alone 2.
Yeah, it was Home Alone 2, the Sticky Bandits. Home Alone 2.
The Wet Bandits was Home Alone 1.
Oh, was it?
Yes.
They had the best name.
Oh, okay, all right.
That's delightful. Thank you. Thank you for that remembrance from youth. So the Harp brothers ended up at a place called Cave in Rock, Illinois. The wives and children.
Hold on. Back to Cave in the Rocks, Illinois. I looked up this place because I was interested in this part of the story. It's a quaint little town to this date. It is still just like this fun little American town.
Really?
You know, like, yeah, it's not, they've got some interesting things going on there. And it's like one of those things that like just makes you want to look it up, like Cave in the Rocks. They just happen to have one of the coolest underground caves in, like, the northern part of the country.
Interesting. Oh,
yeah, it's an interesting little place.
So it's like the kind of place you could go have, like, a pie-eating contest.
Right. It's also a place that, with these types of cave systems and stuff, a couple of, corn swallower. I don't know. What do you swindlers,
horn swallowing.
Yeah, horn swallowing sons of bitches and shit like that. Yeah, man, this is a place that they would probably want to go because they could easily hide shit.
Yep.
That is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So back to the wives and children. Now, I want to remind everybody who's tuning back in, especially if it's weeks later, the Harps escaped from prison by digging a hole in the wooden wall of the maximum security prison in Danville. And
which was a wooden wall.
It was a wooden wall, yes.
Four
wooden walls. Dug a hole in the wooden walls and escaped, and then just began getting the hell out of there. Yeah. But they left their wives, and they had just had children in that prison system. They left them completely behind. So the wives and children, they made a 200-mile trek down a river in a canoe and over to Cave in Rock, Illinois, which is another 90 miles away. So they made a 290-mile trek with babies in a canoe to meet back up with the Harp boys.
Wow. What I thought interesting about this part is like, how did they get word back? You know? I mean, what kind of system of communications were they getting to these ladies there?
That's actually a great question. So in the book, they talk about this was most likely their plan the entire time.
Oh, they had already had a plan and set, which would make sense.
So in Cave in Rock, the Harps found a new career as river pirates. the career didn't last. The Harps killed a man by blindfolding him and running his horse off a cliff, allegedly to impress their new pirate friends.
Wow.
Yeah. The tack failed. Evidently, the Harps were a little too crazy for frontier-era river pirates, and they were advised to seek opportunities elsewhere.
I mean, if you're fucking more nasty than a river pirate, they're literally rats with knives, guns, and a ferocious attitude for violence.
Yeah, I guess the only way to actually freak out the riverboat pirates is to think it's funny to tie a man to a horse, blindfold the man, whip the horse, and make the whole thing fly off a cliff.
No, I'm not sure these river people only killed if they had to while they were pirating.
Yeah.
And these guys were laughing and loving it when they got this guy to jump off a fucking... Oh, God.
They made sport of it. Yeah, absolutely. So because of that, a little snafu, they moved to Knoxville, Tennessee, and
didn't they already spend some time in Knoxville?
Yeah, they're just making a big spiral. If you're actually
going back.
Yeah,
careful.
If you actually just take a map and kind of draw, you end up with an interesting
spirograph. Like 1980s spirograph style design. Yeah,
where it's like if you try to blindfold yourself and write to really tap into your psyche, it really doesn't turn out. Or my psyche God. Is just a spiraling mess. It's probably more the case. So they moved to Knoxville, Tennessee, and the bodies honestly began to pile up at that point. Which is funny, because they did spend time there, and now they're back. They still have a price on their heads for a sizable sum.
Bounty, right?
They're getting $50,000 USD today.
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Exactly. That's enough to buy yourself a brand new Jeep, Forrest.
Right, exactly.
Anyway. They did find one person, as the bodies began to pile up, they found one person who had his brains smashed against a tree.
Wow.
Evidently, these two gentlemen, I use the term extraordinarily loosely, found this person and didn't like what he had to offer, or he was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and just beat him against the tree. The theory is they wanted to throw off the scent and make it look like, a horse had kicked him or something like that. There were more that were found in the river with rocks where their insides used to be. Again, their calling card. The Harps were almost caught when they ran into two brothers who were part of a posse searching for them.
A good posse.
I know, so many posses.
That's like you made a dollar, though, back then, man. If you can get the bounty on somebody's head, man, that's got a lot of money.
50 grand. Yeah. I mean, I'd split that with the two of you.
I would spend 2 months doing that versus working in a field all fucking summer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, making $9. So the Harps were almost caught when they ran into two brothers who were part of a posse searching for them. The Harps overpowered and killed one of the brothers, but the other one got away. So being the nomadic type, they continued to kill their way back to Tennessee. They murdered John Tully on a wilderness path and a man and his 13-year-old son in their own homestead.
Wow.
They left the body of the little boy and a small girl who had been beaten into a tree.
Like, same faith that other gentleman did?
Yeah.
Basically just beat into a tree.
Wow.
Again, this is the darker half of this story.
Oh, yeah.
Most definitely.
Very dark.
Yeah, and I'm sort of glossing over some of these because it gets worse.
Uh-oh.
Then the Harps ran into an encampment of the Trisward brothers, their wives, and their, quote, servants.
Oh, good Lord.
I use quotes because their servants probably weren't paid.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As was the style.
Exactly.
All were slaughtered. Some like to say that Cherokees assisted the Harps, but it was more of a frontier safety blanket than anything factual. In other words, people at the time had such disbelief that anyone could be capable of that much carnage that they assumed it was a party.
Well, and then to discuss that whole concept, the safety blanket, what Herman's talking about is that they would honestly, like he said, would rather say that a bunch of Cherokee savages were slaughtering these people when literally two men could have just rounded them all up and destroyed them. And in the Hart brothers, their MO is all over this, especially if it's on their way to somewhere else. But the Cherokee Indians, again, brought into that whole... They're savages that no white colonial person could do this at that time.
Yeah,
and it was that fear of the natives, the fact that it's like
fear mongering.
Well, yeah, fear mongering, and it was their way of scapegoating an actual event in that way. Is like, because Americans had been fighting for 100 years at this point with the native people, the First Nation people.
Yeah,
and. The people who sided with the British during this whole part were the savages, and let's blame it on the native first, the First Nation persons.
Yeah,
again, the whole scapegoating thing.
Yeah,
yeah, and a
security blanket, as you said.
And it's also a little more comfortable that you could blame it on quote monsters, right? Rather than just two men can come into your camp and destroy your entire family.
Completely murderous, serial killing. And again, they had no concept of serial killers at that time.
No, that didn't come out until the 70s.
Exactly.
So the Harps continuing to be on the run. with their wives and children included now, mind you. They were there when all this stuff happened.
Wow.
They took to living in camps in the woods. Big Harp, known to be a little violent if his sleep was interrupted, was awoken by one of the Harp babies.
Wow.
He quieted the infant by grabbing it by the heels and repeatedly smashing the child into a tree. Some say this was his own son or daughter, and others that the baby was his brother's son.
Wow.
He woke up in a fit of rage because this child was crying for us. And what he did was he grabbed this infant by the feet and just smashed it against a tree.
That's so fucked up.
Until it was quieted. And I guess, I guarantee you, he dropped it on the ground and went to go lay back down.
He definitely went back to sleep.
And fell quietly asleep.
Oh, God, these guys are ridiculous.
That's how fucking brutal Big Harp is, dude. He is a monster.
Yeah.
A monster. I would have loved to known historically what this kid's child life was like.
Oh, God. No, you don't.
I don't. But good Lord.
Yeah, right.
So the Harp settled in a place called Henderson, Kentucky, which, mind you, it's all in the same area, and they've had a price on their heads, but somehow we're just not recognized. After killing a man named Slover, the Harps were discovered, and spies were actually assigned to locate them. Now, of course, being as slippery as they were, the Harps managed to wriggle out of this situation and were once again on the move. During their travels, they arrived at the home of a man by the name of Moses Stiegel. Now, this is actually very famous. Moses's wife answered the door and said that her husband was away on some business. She advised the Harps that they could not stay as the loft in the house was already occupied by a man named Mr. Love.
I love this.
Mr. Love.
Oh, yeah. Mr. Love. But no, this is the Darker Side podcast.
Yeah, what was she doing with Mr. Love?
He was asleep in the loft, mind you.
Yeah, he was asleep in the loft.
Asleep in the loft.
So Big Harp told Moses' wife, quote, "That makes no never mind to us. We'll just join him, be up at dawn before he rises, and be gone with no one the wiser." Mrs. Stiegel, of course, led them into the house, urging them not to wake her colicky baby, and led them to the loft.
Mm.
The story goes that snoring away in the loft was Love, with the Harp brothers trying to settle in for sleep. Little Harp was said to say, "Jesus, he is loud. How are we going to get any sleep with that going on?" Big Harp grabbed his knife and slit Love's throat, and the two brothers went immediately to sleep.
Quietly to sleep.
Wow.
As Mr. Love. I just picture Mr. Love that's just happy, Love, just loving bro, who's just like, "Oh, man, I'm staying at a B&B. This shit's fucking tits."
What if they, like, I can...
And he's all like, oh man, and that wife, oh, she got some birthing hips on her. I'm gonna have some fun with her.
Hell yeah!
And that's what he was doing for the last. You know, he was staying at a B&B for a few days until he got on to whatever he was doing.
To just being crusty frontier people.
Yeah.
My God.
But good Lord, and he didn't meet a very loving end at all.
No, I mean, at least he was asleep and didn't have to really be.
That's true. You know, good on him for that.
So the next morning, the Harps went down the stairs, and Mrs. Stiegel answered them and advised that there would be no breakfast because the four-month-old baby, who again was colicky, was coughing, wheezing, and crying. Big Harp offered to rock the baby to sleep while Mrs. Stiegel cooked breakfast.
That Oz is...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sit on that for a second. She agreed. She probably just needed a break. You know, every now and then you want somebody else to watch your kids. So you need some crazy friends.
Ask any mother who of either one child, multiple child, just a woman who's got... You know, ask Rachel.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
Ask any woman. Yeah.
So if you've ever witnessed a colicky baby, they just scream constantly because they're miserably in pain. There's an operation you could do for that. Usually it has something to do with the esophagus not closing and them having incredible indigestion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but a baby not sleeping means nobody in the house is sleeping.
Yeah, nobody in the house. Except for Mr. Love, I guess, can sleep through that. The Harps quieted down the baby to Mrs. Stiegel's astonishment. She actually asked the brothers how they had quieted down her baby that actually never stopped crying. So she went to the crib to move the blankets and saw that her infant son was in fact quiet because his throat had been slit. The startling realization of the horror that had happened was fresh with Mrs. Stiegel, who uttered a blood-curdling scream as Big Harp plunged the bloody knife into her heart, silencing the woman as he had silenced her son.
Oh, God.
So after that, the Harps ate a nice, quiet breakfast, Then they set the house on fire by rounding up the Siegel's dogs, putting them in the house, while setting the blankets on fire in the stove, which had piled on it a few chairs, and the cradle with the dead Siegel infant still in it.
Wow.
Yeah, these guys are fucked. So, evidently, they may have crossed a few people's lines with this one.
A few? I mean, the entire decent, loving people population of humanity, I'm pretty sure that they crossed that line.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I read this a few times. I'm like, they actually piled
the
dead baby?
They killed a baby?
Mm-hmm.
They killed a new mother?
Mm-hmm.
They killed a fucking guy named Mr. Love.
You can't
And
do
then
that.
They fucking burned all of the dogs along with all the dead bodies alive in that house.
So when
they crossed a lot of lines.
When they set when they set the house on fire, the dogs began howling as burning creature would do. Big Harp was supposed to have said they probably smell hell.
Oh my god. Coming from Big Harp's mouth, that was like yeah. God damn, they probably smell hell.
So naturally, because of the fire and the death of his entire family, Moses Siegel was slightly incensed by this. People went after the Harps, and they're said to have killed two folks that were chasing them after the fire. But it was a neighbor of Stiegel's, Silas McBee, who raised a...
posse.
That's the one.
Oh, man.
Including Siegel, who had actually just lost his entire family to this.
Wow.
They struck out in search of the Harps. McBride came upon the Harps in a camp and raced in to seize them. In the fray, the Harps escaped. Big Harp rode off on his horse, and Little Harp ran into the wilderness. McBee went off in search of Little Harp and heard a noise in the woods. He took aim and shot, hitting his mark, though not the intended target. He shot a settler named George Smith, who was hiding from the Harps.
Smith, right? He gets a bullet. And it's intended for somebody else. It's intended for Little Harp, right?
Yeah.
Little Harp. And this dude is just trying to make a fucking life for himself in the woods, gets shot as this. I mean, but hey, wrong time, man. Oh, yeah. God. Good. Sorry, Mr. Smith.
I'm Smith.
So, yeah, it's probably real.
It is forced. It's probably, well, he's definitely not one of the ones that continued your line. But yeah.
So four of the posse overtook Big Harp, who, when he saw them, trained his musket on the leader, John Lepier. The musket misfired, so Harp charges on his horse after Lepier with his tomahawk held high and murder in his cold black eyes. Lepier kept his cool and took aim, firing and hitting Harp in the torso. Now slumped and bleeding in his saddle, Big Harp said he was ready to surrender. He was pulled off his horse to the ground. He begged for water, and it was McBee who obliged, by filling his shoe with water from a nearby creek and offering a frontier Das Boot to Harp.
Das Boot.
Wow, nice.
Was it Beer Game? Beer Games? What's the name of that Broken Lizards movie?
Beer Fest.
Beer Fest.
Beer Fest.
Yes.
I love that
Das
movie.
Boot.
Das Boot.
Yeah. So here's your shoe full of water.
Harp was asked to confess, and he did, saying that he only regretted killing his own son.
Now, is that the only thing? That's a question that I had. Is that the only thing that he said at this matter, or did he actually confess to everything?
So that's a great question. That's a matter of speculation. There's some that say that he confessed to absolutely everything. Others say that it was just the murder of his own son. It's a colder story to say that the only thing that ever affected him was smashing his own baby into a tree. But
yeah,
I mean, it's also the most human thing that he could have thought about at that point.
Right.
I regret nothing else but killing my own child.
That makes more sense to me, to be honest.
Yeah.
But, you know, the child was probably better off knowing who the father was. So, but, you know, so, amen to that. Or, you know, God rest its soul.
There's remorseless Big Harp lying on the ground. And it was left up to Siegel to cut off Big Harp's head. Some say while Harp was still alive and kicking, Moses Siegel cut the thing off.
Well, this is Siegel... Moses Siegel is the one who killed his family, right?
The whole family and Mr. Love, which is probably his business partner.
Well, I mean, if anybody was to cut his head off, it would have been him for sure.
Well, yeah, you give that guy that honor.
Oh, Lord.
Some say that Siegel actually shot Harp first, which I prefer to believe because it's really cold to slowly slice somebody's head off with a buck knife, but either way. Regardless, it was displayed as a deterrent for any would-be highwaymen to see. Just kind of the head was shoved in a tree. for years, actually.
Wow.
Little Harp did manage to escape, and the Harp ladies were arrested for their presumed part in the Stiegel killings and were found...
Guilty?
No! No, they were found innocent, of course.
Oh, well, good. That's good, though.
Yeah, the ladies were innocent, dude.
Yeah. They, what they said was that the Harp brothers wanted to kill all of the children to speed up their flight.
Ah.
Yeah. Oh. Which I believe. It was years later, in 1804, when Little Harp surfaced again using the alias of John Seton. He and a friend named May were attempting to collect the bounty on a highwayman named Samuel Mason. They did this by bringing in the carefully preserved head of Mason that had been split by a tomahawk.
Oh, yeah.
Harp was recognized, of course.
Wasn't he a fiery redhead?
Yeah. Oh, totally.
I mean, so he...
Fiery redhead with blue eyes that split somebody's head open with a tomahawk. He's not that far away. He was in Natchez when he did this.
But I mean, like, you're an idiot, dude, to think that you're not going to be recognized. You were a small breed of people. You're a fucking fiery redhead with blue eyes.
Yeah.
You've got the South, you know? You've got a partner. Use him. But I mean, at the same time, these guys have gotten away with everything pretty much. And this guy especially.
Sneaky bastards, man, for sure.
He actually wasn't even recognized until he brought the head to court. They had to raise money in Natchez. They had to raise money to pay the bounty for Samuel Mason. And they did. He goes to try to collect the bounty in court, and Harp and May were bound, getting ready for trial, but they...
escaped?
One more time.
Oh, good Lord.
They escaped, and the locals formed a... Anyone?
Posse.
A posse. Yeehoo! They formed the posse to apprehend him, and this time Little Harp was not so lucky. He and May were beheaded in accordance with the custom of frontier justice. Their heads were displayed as a warning for thieves and murderers for years to come.
Fuck yeah.
Good Lord, dude. how do we know about this? I mean, again, this is one of those things that I feel like... When I first heard about it, the suggestion from, again, our listener and our friend Greg Kosnowski brought this up to me. I had no idea about these gentlemen, these colonial serial killers. These guys were literal monsters.
Yeah,
absolutely. They were actually written about at the time, but people didn't believe the stories.
Right, but was it because of that whole security blanket thing that no white Anglo human being could be possible of such savagery?
I mean, probably the misguided belief that a couple of Scottish immigrants couldn't do this.
That's true. That's very true. It's a very interesting topic because, again, this is colonial times, people. This is the onset of America. This is that turmoilic time in our history where this country was trying to get itself together, and these savages are running around the upper Midwest of our country and the South just killing for fun.
Yep.
Granted, you know, it kind of reminds me of like a Devil's Rejects type of thing where they're a tight knit family, but their business was killing.
And business was good.
Yeah. Yep.
So they say that they have killed anywhere from, I've read 20 to 50 people.
They could have honestly, with all the undocumented deaths and savagery, they could have killed way more than that. 100. And we would honestly never know.
My guess is at some point, the rocks in the belly had to have worked.
You know, in part one, when you started, when you told us about the first official Harp brothers killing death, it made me question how many did they not know of the unofficial possible first bodies of these two growing up, or you know, on their
during
ways.
The Revolutionary War, even
how much fun did they have killing during the battlefields?
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, war is a great place to cover up savagery, but I mean, they could have been killing these serial killing motherfuckers all the time.
Yep.
Mm.
You know,
they could have been
killing their own people and you know anybody that crossed them and just blamed it on the war.
Yeah,
it's fucking incredible. It's an incredible topic. I'm very happy that we dive deeper into this topic.
Me too.
Yeah, and again, I cannot recommend enough this book, Killer Brothers, A Biography of the Harp Brothers, America's First Serial Killers by Wallace Edwards, available on Amazon. It's like $3. It's awesome. It's really nice. Good. Really well written, and it's you know, as dark as it is, it's kind of fun to read. And I definitely, that was my go-to for the story. And
awesome, man.
I want to thank the author for that.
And what, Greg? Krasnowski, thank you very much for bringing this to our attention.
Thank you, Greg.
We can't say that enough, because the Hart brothers are definitely something that I haven't heard in any type of history class or podcast or anything else.
It would literally make the darkest movie. You probably wouldn't even be able to show it in the U.S. and be rated NC-17 or something like that.
I would love to make a movie like
this. Yeah, I mean, like, just the imagery of the children beatings and stuff is just horrible.
I bet.
Just thinking about somebody's entire head smashed into a big old giant southern oak.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that.
Like, oh, good
one of them, yeah, man. One of them ant-covered turpentine pines.
Yep.
All right, guys. Well, that was the Darker Side Podcast, episode 20.
Boom.
Fucking 2-0, baby.
Boom.
We've reached another milestone. Everybody, I am David, and thank you again for coming to the Darker Side. You can reach me at Facebook at David Pottle, P-O-T-T-L-E. You can find my band at Frenemy Providence. That's F-R-N-E-M-Y. You can also check out our network at DCP Network on Facebook and all the other bullshits. We've got some great podcasts under our belt, and a couple new ones possibly in the pipeline.
Heck yeah.
Again, you can find me on all the other social media bullshits. Just look up David Pottle.
Yep.
Forrest, what do you got?
You got me, I'm on Facebook, you know, Forrest.
When
G.
did you start talking like I'm Forrest and I'm pretty badass looking?
Hey.
I heard a story about the South, so now I'm going to talk deep South.
Yeah.
Give me a sack of milk and a bowl of nails.
Yeah. I'm on Facebook. I'm on, you know, all that good stuff. Forrest G Media is on Facebook.
Getting lost in the forest.
Glit F. Glit F.
GLITF.
GLITF. I'm on Facebook, Podbean, iTunes, Google Play, all that great stuff. We're also on all that on Darker Side Podcast. We're also on Spotify, which is awesome. I love Spotify.
Yeah, you can see all those. Soon your podcast will be on Spotify. And again, DCP Network, guys, like our page.
Please.
We're just going to bring you really incredible content.
Hell yeah.
Just bear with us while we get all that stuff established.
Hell yeah.
Boom.
Herman, what do you got, brah?
I'm invisible.
Hell yeah.
Or you can find me on Instagram at Herman Brow. That's HERRMANNBRAU at Instagram. Send me pictures of your cats and stuff.
Hashtag motorcycle in front of stuff.
My bike in front of stuff.
My bike in front of
stuff. Heck yeah.
It's a good hashtag, John. Yeah,
block your scenery with your motorcycle. Or your bicycle. I don't care. I'm not equal opportunity. Whatever right. You ride. 49 cc's, it's fine.
Whoever, whatever you ride.
I ride.
Equal opportunity.
Hell yeah.
Get out in the wind, brother.
All right, guys. Well, that was the Darker Side Podcast. Until next time.
Until next time.
Come back to the Darker Side.
Darker Side.
Parker. That's so creepy, you guys. I don't want to scare him.
Heal yourselves.
Boom.